Today is Thursday. It's October 8th, 2020, the worst year ever. It's also 1:38 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. We record via Zoom. I'm at WGN Radio, and you can hear me weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
I'm Lisa Donovan. I write the Spin Politics newsletter for the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Eric Zorin, the frustrated columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
I'm so disappointed, Eric. That's not all that clever. What's with frustrated?
That's my mood after last night's vice presidential debate, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. I'm just frustrated that nobody seemed to know how to answer a question.
That's topic number two on my agenda. I also want to talk about the Fair Tax Amendment a little bit more, too. That's been lighting up our phone lines at WGN Radio. Let's start here. 34 people connected to the White House have COVID-19. That's the latest count I saw, including the president, the first lady, White House spokesperson, top aides, even members of the White House cleaning services are now infected. And that doesn't even include the fly. In our fourth year of You Won't Believe What He Did Next, the president left Walter Reed Hospital, COVID positive, took off his mask and walked into the White House. In fact, he did it twice. They were filming his triumphant return and wanted to get it just right. The president is today declining to participate in that October 15th virtual debate. He said they'd cut you off at any time. They would, by the way. I still don't see the need for any more debates, but just in general, let's talk a little bit about the president's week.
It just feels to me like his campaign is sort of falling apart. The thing you didn't mention, which was very peculiar, was that on Wednesday afternoon? Now I'm thinking it was maybe Tuesday afternoon, that Trump tweeted out that he was going to stop negotiations on stimulus relief, which was the one thing that looked like it might give him a chance at reelection, was putting a bunch of more money into people's pockets and keeping the economy bobbing along, at least artificially so. And it was so unpopular that it caused the stock market to go into a bit of a tailspin that he sort of changed it a little bit, and now he's somewhere in the middle there. But boy, I mean, since we last spoke, he went into the hospital, came out, and has made COVID-19 the issue again of the campaign, as though it was going to maybe fade away a little bit.
We still don't know, I think, the answer to the fundamental question. When did he last test negative for COVID-19? Because that will be crucial for us to know sort of who he and his staff might have exposed in that interim. Because the CDC tells us that a typical case takes 3 to 5 days to develop severe symptoms. So that means that he would have been infected the Monday before the Friday that he announced the positive. We know that he traveled all around between then and now. But I think that's just a crucial question that I hope our compatriots on the White House beat keep pressing, because I think that we as a country should know how many people can trace their infections to the president's reelection campaign.
What you heard the president say, too, today was that we're going to forgo this October 15th debate. We'll just have a rally. We also need to know if he's still infectious. So understanding that date and that time is equally key. Who did he infect and when? And then going forward, should he be out holding these rallies, potentially infecting voters?
Do we all agree with the idea that this COVID bout that the president suffered gave him yet another opportunity to sort of reset his image and his approach to this virus, that he could have been someone who sort of came out of the hospital in a chastened and newly awoken attitude toward this virus, telling people that you've got to take it seriously, we've got to really get this under control, I now see what people have suffered. All the statements that he's been making have been about himself, if you notice. He doesn't even talk about the First Lady. He doesn't talk about all the other people who have suffered.
He said he's cured. He said he was cured.
He said he's cured. He's feeling like he did 20 years ago, which sounds to me like the steroids talking.
He also said it was a blessing. I mean, can you imagine how folks feel who have come down with this and are still ailing? People who have lost loved ones. and are hearing from somebody saying, you know, don't let it get the best of you. Don't let it dominate.
Well, as soon as I get a Marine One helicopter, I'll cop that attitude. But until I get a team of 15 doctors, a helicopter, and a hospital at my beck and call, of course it dominates people's lives. That he didn't see the disconnect there between the treatment he gets and the treatment everybody else gets.
Well, and it was weird because, like I said, I think he had a chance to, like, he had another reset button that he could have pushed, and he just seems incapable of doing that.
That would not have happened unless, like, if he had an ayahuasca experience deep in the Amazon, maybe he would come back with sort of a different approach to admitting fault or kind of trying to turn a new leaf on certain things. But that his response was not surprising to me. This whole thing for the last week, I've felt it feels deeply Soviet to me for some reason. That's the word that keeps coming into my head because of all the personality based, like, political theater. It's all about, it's very reality show. It's totally devoid of, like, substance. It's all almost, it's a celebrity obsessed sort of mess. And it's a constant war of, you know, who was where, when, who, you know, who was in the Rose Garden. It's like a mystery novel or something. And it's just deeply saddening to me how horribly that's been mismanaged. I mean, we all work for pretty, like, decent sized employers. I don't know anyone who at their workplace has seen extensive spread of COVID, like what just occurred, if there's 30 plus people. And I think that's a black eye.
Well, certainly Lisa and I are working from home, and I don't think there's anybody in the Tribune newsroom to spread it to, even if we were sick. So, it looks to me, from as I watch Channel 11, Heather, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys are pretty careful about keeping your distance from one another, and I know you report from home a lot. So,
yeah.
And I've never seen Austin out of the house so in the last 6 months. So I'm guessing he's pretty safe too. So that's. It's John who I'm worried about. You actually go to work, John.
I do, and I'll here's a confession, because I've been a little obstinate about the mask in the building. I've been here since March. I haven't missed a day in the office, and there was only a few of us, and we were not wearing masks inside. We were very distanced. We're in studios, etc. And now more people are coming back in, including my producer, who's really apprehensive about this. And she and I have had a little bit of a rift. She wears a mask all the time. I don't want to wear a mask indoors all the time. After the president got sick and they had this super spreader event, I'm wearing a mask in my office at my computer terminal now. And I hate that. And I also don't like to sort of give in. I don't know what the thing is that has been holding me up, but why I was so stubborn about that element of safety. But now, after the president's thing, I'm like, hell, I'm no different if I don't wear a mask. So I'm doing it indoors now, even in my office, for which she thanked me. And I'm being a complete ass about it. I know. He's actually gotten me to wear the mask indoors. There was some good that came from that.
Well, and think of all the people that he could have influenced if he had come out of the hospital. Like I say, a different kind of guy who said, like, you know, this is really serious. You've really got to you've really got to wear your mask. You really got to keep your distance. We've made some mistakes at the White House. We're not going to do that going forward. But instead, it's all this. It's this defiance. And so I wrote a column the other day saying, no, I do not wish the president a speedy recovery, because I think a speedy recovery is telling him the wrong things about this virus, and clearly has, the way he's talking about it. I mean, I hope that I don't like to wish suffering on anyone, but if he recovers quickly and just is all better, he's going to think it's really nothing. It really is just like the sniffles, as he said, or like the flu, just the flu. And that sends a message to all kinds of people who cannot be as casual as he has been, who don't have helicopters to take him to the hospital and a team of doctors to look after him.
The New York Times reported that the Trump campaign explicitly hoped to use this as sort of an attempt to reset, and that they had been counseling him to come out of the hospital only when his doctors sort of gave him the all clear, and that, you know, to be, you know, to take the approach Eric was described, and he just flat out refused. I think that my mom was a nurse, so we always took, like, medical stuff very, very seriously. And I gotta say, it was just so disheartening to also have to sort of explain this to my daughters. You know, the president is sick. He's in the hospital. You know, the government is still operating. I mean, it's just another one of those conversations that I never in a million years thought I would have to have with my kids, but that I, you know, have had to sort of swallow my own sort of terror and anxiety and sort of say, look, it's, you know, government's still functioning. We hope he's going to be okay. But, you know, he got sick because he wasn't following the rules, which is why it's so important that we follow the rules. And, you know, they're not in school. They're doing remote. Their school is reopening next week. They're not going back because I don't think it's safe. You know, we've heard from the CDC that they want a test positivity rate of somewhere in the neighborhood of 2%. Park Ridge is closer to 3%. The city is closer to four, a little bit over 4%. So, you know, it's just so hard to sort of explain. We have to follow the rules, even if other people didn't. And it's just another added layer of anxiety.
The thing that I cannot get past is sort of, there are all these various levels of sort of officials who are supposed to sort of stand up and represent, I mean, sort of be beacons of honesty and leadership. And yet we have sort of that sort of, you know, untruths, half truths coming from the White House, skirting questions from a doctor. And all of that sort of plays into people's minds right now. We're worried about getting sick, but here's this guy who is the White House physician, and he's not answering questions and sort of being coy about it. I think it all plays into sort of that added anxiety, because a lot of anxiety is about what's unknown. You feel like you can't trust what's coming out of the White House. You feel like you can't trust what's coming out of a top physician's mouth, somebody who is also a member of the military.
So. Well, I agree with what Austin said. It has a Soviet feel. It also has a feel of like Italy in World War II, you know, with Mussolini going up on the balcony, or Argentina with Evita on the balcony. It's like it's got this whole sort of dictatorial quality to it, all the theatrics of it. And again, I don't see this as him playing the hand that he's been dealt very well.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I keep going back to 2016, and I think we're right around the time that we had the Hillary's email surprise 4 years ago. Certainly, I think yesterday, the 7th, was the 4-year anniversary of the Access Hollywood tape, which we all thought that's the end of Donald
wow.
Trump.
Well, this has become my like long-running pet peeve and party trick that I would amaze people with if I went to parties anymore. But, you know, October 7th, 2016 is one of those days that there are going to be whole books written about that one day, because not only did you have the Access Hollywood tape, you had the Obama administration's sort of, you know, saying that it was the determination of the intelligence agencies that Russia was intervening in the election on Donald Trump's behalf. And then you had the deluge of emails from the Democratic National Committee from WikiLeaks. All three of those things, you know, had a huge impact on the outcome of the 2016 election. Even if it had just been the Access Hollywood tape, I think, you know, it would have been, I think, different. But all three of those things happening one day within, you know, about a month of Election Day is just, it boggles my mind.
I wondered whether some of it was sort of a drown out situation, though. I recognize that sort of all of that came in at once, whether all of that stuff kind of drowned out and people like, ugh, I'm sick of it, because I'm already hearing that after last night's debate, a lot of people are tuned out.
So many reporters who said after that Access Hollywood tape, there's no way that this person could be elected president. Remember, there were, you know,
there were
Paul Ryan saying, dude, please save the party, step down, let Mike Pence run. You know, like that was just the conventional wisdom. And I think that led so many reporters to concentrate very heavily on the Clinton DNC emails, because the sense was that, of course, she's going to be the next president after this. So let's focus on that. And I think we've heard that Jim Comey, that calculation played into his decision to reopen the investigation of Hillary's emails on October 27th.
Well, the release of the emails, that was not just a pure coincidence, right? I mean,
correct.
It wasn't, there was the access, this was a counter to the Access Hollywood tape. But
we know that from the conviction. conviction of Roger Stone for lying to Congress.
But my broader point was just that I think it's too early for anyone to say that they know how things are going to turn out on November 3rd or whatever happens in the week after November 3rd.
The needle is moving right now, Eric, though. I mean, after all that Heather has just said, maybe the needle didn't move that much, right, on Donald Trump in 2016. But Nate Silver, Politico, they're showing in the last week from the presidential debate through his going to Walter Reed that he's not picking up any points. There does seem to be a cost for his behavior of late.
Biden is closer in Texas right now than Trump is in Ohio. And I feel like saying those words in that order is, you know, makes me feel crazy because that's not what we expected the state of affairs to be right now.
I want to talk a little bit about the vice presidential debate, although I take your point, Lisa, that people are probably fatigued about all of this, but I'm the one that is saying we don't need another presidential debate. I'm the one saying we don't need another vice presidential debate. I think we could be done right now. Fact checks post vice presidential debate was 13 pages long. Mm-hmm. There was some information in that debate, but there were some lies. But you got the measure of the candidates. That's how I judge these things. Nothing really to learn there, except that that's what Kamala Harris is like. That's what Mike Pence is like. And there were no great revelations. Kamala Harris would not answer a question about packing the Supreme Court. Mike Pence would not comment on a peaceful transference of power.
And neither of them would answer directly whether they had had a conversation with their bosses about transferring power, as in if one of them became disabled and unable to fulfill the duty of president, at what point would they step in, you know, and had they had that conversation? That was the most important thing to me, because besides them being a tie-breaking vote in the Senate, the vice president's job is just to sort of be this person in waiting to run this country. And you have two candidates for president who are in their 70s, one who has COVID, which has proven deadly to 200,000 plus Americans. You have another presidential candidate who is going to be 78 when he's sworn in, Biden. And I think these are valid questions that should be answered directly. Pence went back to another question saying, we did do a good job, you know, responding to COVID-19, and we're going to have a vaccine. And Kamala Harris, she answered it, I guess, essentially saying, I'm ready to step into that job. I've been a district attorney in San Francisco. I've been the California AG. And as such, I'm a member of the Department of Justice. And I'm now a U.S. Senator and serving on the Intelligence Committee. So I guess she sort of answered that. But I really think that hurts when they're not answering directly.
I thought it was a badly worded question. The question that Kamala Harris was answering was, are you ready to step in should, you know, God forbid you should become not, mm-hmm. That the president should die. That was sort of the question, but have you had a conversation about that? That was a very strange way of doing it. But it gets to my frustration with this debate, which was that I don't know if it was in the rules or if it was just moderator Susan Page's personality, but she did not follow up on a lot of these things. I mean, there was the question about, you know, what is the health plan that the Trump administration has? They keep alluding to this idea that they're going to protect pre-existing conditions, but you never hear what their plan is. And they, you know, she asked specifically, how do you protect pre-existing conditions? And I forget what tangent he went off on, but both candidates, if you try to look at it in as neutral a way as possible, both candidates just took the questions as mere vague suggestions as to subject areas that they wanted to go off on or the opportunity to revisit a previous question. And so mm-hmm. as much, I just thought Susan Page lost control of the debate. And so you hear the most common line of the night was, thank you, Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President.
And over and over again.
Well, thank you, Mr. Zorn. If I had to pick a winner, I would have said Mike Pence last night. Would you guys explain to me why the Democrats don't answer that question about packing the Supreme Court? What's the deal with that? Say yes. You know, it only requires a law. It's not a constitutional amendment. Own it if you want it. And if you don't, say no. The fact that they absolutely dodge it just makes them look scheming. It makes them look slimy.
Nobody wants to have that on an ad. I mean, in an ad saying, yes, I'm going to pack the Supreme Court. If the question is, I think that's one where you sort of redirect, like, are we going to try to pick people who share our philosophy? Yes. Just be honest about it. Both sides are trying to pack the court in their favor.
Well, but that means add on. I read that question, though, to be not just are you going to get, you know, 9 justices that agree with you, but are you going to add 6 more, right? Isn't that what that is, yeah. Lisa? Well, okay.
And she did pivot to say, like, something to the effect of, well, Donald Trump's, you know, packing the court with people that agree with him.
Yeah.
Packing the 9-member court. But yeah, I think it's a totally legit question, and it did get dodged. And both of them dodged the questions all night. It was very much in the vein of a, not in a debate, but in a concurrent joint press conferences happening at the same time. And I think the only policy knowledge I think that was gained was that I could tell, at least, was Kamala saying that she would push for decriminalization at the federal level of marijuana, which I believe would make her the highest profile candidate in history to call for that. Other than that, unless I missed something, I didn't see any, like, you know, policy kind of news besides dodging the question about the Supreme Court.
What struck me was Mike Pence refusing or declining to give a full-throated endorsement of his life's goal of overturning Roe versus Wade. You know, he was clearly invited to do so by Susan Page, and he dodged that question as well, which for Mike Pence, if you know anything about his history in Indiana and sort of, you know, how he's approached his political life, that I think signals a huge change in sort of abortion politics and sort of the politics of Roe versus Wade. And we heard Trump do something very similar in the last debate, where he said Roe versus Wade wasn't on the ballot, which of course it is. And I was fascinated to see that, because there are any number of clips out there on YouTube of Mike Pence saying that abortion should be not only not legal, but criminal. And that was just a huge sea change for me, for him not to sort of take that opportunity to sort of full-throatedly say, look, we're on the verge of overturning Roe versus Wade, which, let's be honest, that's where we are, and sort of claim credit for that, which has really been his life's work as a politician. And I don't really know what to make of that. I'm honestly just sort of amazed by that.
Don't you think he was reading the polls? He knows that, well, that's his life's work. He knows that that's not what America wants. So he wasn't going to put his marker on that. That doesn't get you people in between, does it, Heather?
Sure, I don't think it does, but I think that Mike Pence has been so public and so prominent an advocate of overturning Roe versus Wade, and it has never been popular to overturn Roe versus Wade. Like, there was never majority support for that. So he has staked out this lonely position for decades, and now, just as it appears, if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed to the Supreme Court, that they're on the verge of doing that, now suddenly it's untouchable, and I don't know what to make of that.
And he knows. He said, oh, I don't know how Amy Coney Barrett's going to vote on this. Like, everybody knows that she took out a newspaper ad or was signed a newspaper ad many years ago saying that she thought it was wrongly decided.
He's also said that it has been decided. So,
well, but what does that mean? Yeah, I mean, that's stating the obvious. It's been decided, but it isn't over yet. I don't think anyone
suggested a hands off approach. So, I mean, I don't know what cases are coming before the Supreme Court on it.
Well,
there's the case Obamacare. Out of Alabama. There's a case out of Georgia. I mean, there was a spate of these laws passed by legislatures in the South, which they hoped would reach the Supreme Court now with Kavanaugh on it. And I think that having Amy Coney Barrett there makes, you know, it even more likely that it would be overturned.
I thought they'd overturn that Louisiana law. So I thought that kind of set the precedent there that perhaps those laws were not going to, those laws probably wouldn't stand in those.
Well, what that case did, if you remember, Lisa, was that John Roberts, who voted to uphold an almost identical Texas law, voted to overturn the Louisiana law because he wanted to set the idea of precedent. But John Roberts may be in the lonely minority. I mean, he may not even be a swing vote anymore. To get back to John's question about why Harris and Biden are so squirrely about packing the Supreme Court is because the Democratic Party is really split on that. And there are people who are really red hot for them to add, you know, four justices or two anyway, to make up for what the Republicans have done, to take these kind of seats that appear stolen from them and do that. And there's a bunch, there are also a number of Democrats who are much more traditionalists who say, like, no, we have to color inside the lines here in making our political efforts. Same thing, I think, with getting rid of the filibuster. So what you do is you try to make sure that your party stays unified behind you. I think you see the same thing a little bit with fracking. You know, there are a lot of Democrats, working class Democrats, who think that fracking has been a real boon to the U.S. economy and is part of why we have such low gas prices right now. And then there's people who think that this long term is an environmental disaster. So you have to sort of, you know, guide your way through the rocks on those. And I think that's all you're seeing. And again, I think the same thing then is also true on the Republican side with abortion rights. Like, there are a lot of people who are sort of in the middle on abortion rights, which is why Roe v. Wade polls a lot better than just, you know, the pro-life, pro-choice question, is that people feel like, well, at a certain point, it becomes the state's business. At a certain point, it's not the state's business. And that's kind of what Roe v. Wade says, even though it's constitutionally a little bit flabby. So people are willing to let that stand for the most part. And you've got a lot of moderate Republicans who feel like, well, that's the way things are, probably how they should be. So that's politics, right? You try to avoid the questions that you don't want to answer directly.
Well, what was interesting to me was the way that Susan Page framed the question as, if Roe versus Wade is overturned, should Indiana ban abortions? And for Trump to say, or for Pence, I'm sorry, to say, well, I don't really, you know, dodge. I mean, that's just crazy to me.
Didn't she dodge it too, though? Didn't she dodge it relative to California as well?
Kamala Harris, you know, has been pro-life for her entire public career. And if I had seen her sort of, you know, what stuck out to me was Pence not being like, of course Indiana should ban abortions. That was literally his work as governor.
Right.
That's what he tried to do as governor. Like, he restricted contraception. He restricted AIDS care. Like, this is what he did as governor. So if you want to talk about dodging a question or flip-flopping, like, that to me was the most startling, because, you know, I believe him to be sort of a committed evangelical Christian. And if he's no longer willing to sort of articulate those beliefs because they could hurt him in the polls, I think that's something worth, you know, at least holding him accountable for, if nothing else.
I want to leave this topic and go on to a couple of other things. Before we do, though, just everybody give me a real quick summary of who won the debate, or does it matter? Austin, you go first. I said I thought Mike Pence won, but what's your thought on that?
Yeah, I think we all lost, as we all do these things. I'd say, like, in terms of debate technique or tactics, I would say Pence was stronger.
Why did we all lose? I said that about the first debate. I didn't necessarily feel that. Why?
It was two concurrent press conferences again, and like the ratio of substantive content to nothingness is so I don't know if low or high. There's no substance. There's very little substance given how long these things are. And I despise them for that reason.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then I won't ask you any more questions about Heather, who won?
The fly.
Fine. Okay. No one, the fly, Lisa.
I agree with Heather and Austin. I don't think anybody won. Nothing came out of that. They didn't answer the questions. And that's the one thing that Susan Page should have just stopped them and treated them, you know, like maybe the first day kindergartners that they were. You're not answering the questions. I'm going to interrupt you until you get back on page and color in the lines and answer the questions. It was terrible.
Eric Zorn is chosen as his backdrop photo for the Zoom call. I will tell you, I know you can't see it on this podcast, a white background with a giant fly over his head.
I do not agree that the fly won the debate. The fly certainly got a lot of attention. I'm going to give a bit of a wishy-washy answer. I thought that Harris did well in introducing herself to a lot of people out there who really don't know who she is or what she's like. That, you know, I mean, all of us, we're all geeks and nerds, and we saw her at the convention, we've seen her give speeches, we probably saw some of the Democratic debates, we knew who she was. A lot of people didn't and don't. So I think I thought she did a pretty good job doing that. I thought her presentation was good. I liked when she was saying, I'm talking here, I'm speaking, that kind of thing. I thought she did well. I thought Pence did a good job in maybe trying to right the good ship Trump a little bit, to be sort of steady and calm, which he pretty much was. I think his ability, his penchant for talking through his time limits and talking over the attempts to have him yield the floor were a bad look. I think a lot of people who are Republicans were watching that were probably secretly or maybe not so secretly thinking that they wish that this kind of person, if not him directly, was their standard bearer, that he was much more presidential than Trump. And so I thought that he did what he had to do. Harris did what she had to do. And given that the race is where it is, you got to say that because Harris didn't lose, she won.
The Ipsos poll that came out this morning showed that Harris she won on both policy and presentation by about 10 points.
Well, right. And is there a double standard for a Kamala Harris in something like this? Because as a woman, you know, right-wing social media was labeling her as smug and a likability issue. And that may not be fair or nice, but that's true. That is, that's the perception by some people out there. And I don't know that she did a lot. I thought at first she was calm and she smiled and she seemed to stake out a position that I thought was going to help her. And as the debate went on, when she was saying, I'm talking, fair enough, but I don't think that helps that image issue that she has. That's a terribly sexist lens to look at this thing through. I think a lot of the country does look at it that way.
I think
there's probably women out there who would say, I didn't appreciate him, Pence, repeatedly talking over the moderator and talking over Harris. I mean, I think there were equal, I mean, just from what I heard, and even people who are sort of more right-leaning thought, ugh, this is a bad look for Pence. This is just a really bad look for him to be talking over to women.
I mean, I've been in a meeting where I've been interrupted by men, not at my current employer. And I have said, I am speaking. Will you let me finish? And I was, you know, I was told that everybody was talking about what a, you know, B-I-T-C-H I was. And, you know, that's just every professional woman has been in a meeting like that. Every professional woman. And we have all wanted to sort of calmly say, let me finish. And we don't always, you know, have the presence of mind or the composure to it. So I think that probably not all women, but most women saw Kamala Harris trying to sort of assert herself there and said, you know what, she probably did as well as she could.
Right? You know, guys, I was in studio when the governor of Michigan story was breaking. Can you guys catch me up on what this militia group did? They wanted to kidnap her and overthrow the government. What the hell did I miss?
Just that.
They apparently connected at the big protests outside Lansing in March and originally were going to try to sort of fight police officers who were enforcing the stay-at-home order, but decided that their better bet was to kidnap Governor Whitmer, take her to Michigan, to Wisconsin, where they would put her on trial in some form and then execute her. And it's from what we know that most of this planning seems to have been done in Facebook groups, and that they were sort of rounded up after a member of the group said, I should probably call the FBI because this has gotten a little bit out of control. We just heard from Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who was at an unrelated press conference, who was saying, look, I've gotten threats after the president has attacked me, because let's not forget that Trump called on Twitter in April for Michigan to be liberated, and that he called on Governor Whitmer to negotiate with the people who were opposing her stay-at-home order, and said they were, you know, fine Americans.
She did say that the president's rhetoric was to blame for this whole thing unfolding.
The first thing I thought of was the and this is from someone who's generally very pro Second Amendment, the fact that there was, you know, very heavily armed people inside the Michigan Capitol.
Yeah.
I think even if you're a staunch supporter of the Second Amendment, you can recognize that that's sort of a tyrannical display in of itself, and does nothing but align you with insane people like this who committed, who were conspiring to commit this sort of this like harebrained scheme to take over the government and transport Governor Whitmer somehow to someplace. But, wow. Just an insane plot. Yeah. Another 2020.
And they were doing surveillance at their home, like day after day. I mean, it is creepy. I mean, at once you think sort of like, okay, you can see a bunch of people, you know, sitting in their basements, sort of like, oh, okay, let's do this like a video game. But then as you read the story, it just gets creepier and creepier.
The idea of open carry is, I mean, we talked about this in relation to what happened up in Kenosha is I just feel like allowing people to walk around with military style weapons in public, out in the open, is just sort of it's an invitation. It's sort of like pouring gasoline all over the floor and carrying around lighters it's going to inevitably lead to this kind of thing. And you also are hearing talk people about violence. There have been some polling done about violence after the election, and both sides, both people on the extreme left, on the extreme right, are saying that they are expecting or thinking that it might be justified to have a violent reaction to the results of the election. And that is very frightening.
Yeah. Shocked and surprised. But then I sort of said, wait, I shouldn't be, because remember Caesar Sozak, who was the guy who sent pipe bombs to CNN and George Soros and Hillary Clinton. And he was responding to what he heard Trump call him to do. And, I for myself, like, at what point do we stop being surprised that the president's rhetoric, while you certainly can't draw a straight line, has this sort of effect? And I'm surprised, and I sort of feel like I shouldn't be.
I see a little difference between sort of these isolated nutcases and actually an organ. I mean, I think what did they indict? Six or seven people?
Six.
There are six people charged in federal court. There are another seven people charged with state crimes related to this.
When you're actually talking about like even if it's a small movement, it reminds me a little bit of Oklahoma City, where you had a group of militia types.
Well, and they had and Tim McVeigh had ties to Michigan anti-government groups. So you know what I mean? Like this, we've been here before.
That was 26 years ago, something like that. It was Oklahoma
1995.
City.
You know, it's getting a lot of attention still on my radio show, and maybe yours too, if you ever get one. Is this amendment? I hesitate to describe it because Eric and Austin will start to throw punches again.
How about the graduated income tax?
That's what it is. That's what it is. Should we have a graduated income tax in Illinois? Austin, I put Eric on the radio this past week, because he was a little upset about a lawsuit that your organization has filed. Can you tell us what you all are up to over there?
Yeah, well, someone sent me a link to that before the show, and so I went to the bathroom and wiped off my mascara because I wasn't invited, but I'm happy to talk about it. So our lawsuit, it was filed Monday, and the crux of it is folks who received a pamphlet in the mail describing the Progressive Tax Amendment within the last couple of weeks, and now people who are getting their actual ballot in the mail. John, I know you have yours.
Yep.
Many of them reached out to us saying, in confusion or just frustration with the nature of how the question is actually described on the ballot, which I would describe as highly politically biased in favor of the amendment. Oh, there we go. Yeah, Lisa's got one too. We are essentially challenging that violates the free and equal elections clause in the Illinois Constitution because of how misleading that is. And we were joined by three Illinois retirees in that suit. It's very similar to a case that was filed in 2008 against misleading ballot language in Illinois.
So it's not the language
referendum.
Is it the language on the ballot per se, or is it that flyer they sent out to support it?
We challenge both. I think the one that most people are familiar with, though, are the language that's actually on the ballot.
And if you listen to the podcast, and I'm sorry you weren't invited, but Eric raised his hand first and furiously.
It's okay. I'm fine.
But
it's okay.
But I thought I did a pretty good job of scoring the language on that amendment, and I won't bother everybody with my own interpretation of it, but I completely—
How'd you score it?
I completely agreed with you. I feel that the language of the five or so sentences, I think three of them leaned very much in Eric's way, and the other two were neutral. I score everything now. But I thought that the language was biased. I think it it begged you to go with the quote-unquote fair tax. Eric, I don't suppose you agree with me on that, but that's the way I saw it.
I don't. And one thing that strikes me is that the language to which this lawsuit is objecting was passed 5 months ago by the, or a little more than a little less than 5 months ago by the General Assembly. It's been out there all this time. And my belief is that they brought this up and they're complaining about the wording after early voting has already started in order to call attention to this issue that they really want to raise about the possibility that graduated income tax rates will inspire legislators to tax retirement income, which is not taxed in Illinois, which is only one of three states that levy income taxes, state income taxes, that don't tax retirement income. So this is the issue that this lawsuit throws into the news stream at a time when it's advantageous to the people who are campaigning against this referendum. This, if they had a real complaint with this language, don't kid yourself. This, the Illinois Policy Institute and everybody else who's against it has been following this for a long time. They knew that language. They were waiting to drop this now so that they could change the political debate.
To that point, sorry, Eric, you can finish.
No, go ahead. I'm done.
So to that point, even to people who are following this closely, it was not clear to anyone that when people had their ballot, you would figure that they would have the actual text of the amendment on that ballot. I think that's a fair assumption. And that was only what really spurred people, I think, to reach out to us and say, what the heck is going on with this? Is the fact that they knew, because we'd reported on it a lot, what the actual language of the amendment was, and that's nowhere on the ballot. And that to me, I think that's, to any fair-minded person, that is odd, especially because it's about the same length as the explanation itself. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no good reason not to have it on there except to mislead people.
Why not just say taxing above X level, you know, and Y level? I do think these ballot initiatives, they do tend to have the language of the proponents.
Yeah.
The ballot itself, and I haven't seen about the ballot itself does not have the wording of the amendment on it.
No, which is insane. And that's really what we're fighting. And yeah, John, you on
I
your ballot,
right,
you looked
in front
at
of
it.
Me.
Yeah.
Lisa,
yeah.
Could tell
I have
it too.
It right in front
go,
of me.
Go ahead and read it.
Explanation of the amendment. The proposed amendment grants the state authority to impose higher income tax rates on higher income levels, which is how the federal government and a majority of other states do it. The amendment would remove the portion of the revenue article of the Illinois Constitution that is sometimes referred to as the, quote, flat tax, end quote, that requires all taxes on income to be at the same rate. The amendment does not itself change tax rate. It gives the state the ability to impose higher tax rate on those with higher income levels and lower income tax rates on those with middle or lower income levels. You are asked to decide whether the proposed amendment should become part of the Illinois Constitution.
And if we want to do a side-by-side, here's what the actual amendment is. It adds one sentence. The General Assembly shall provide by law for the rate or rates of any tax on or measured by income imposed by the state. Any tax. And the problem with that explanation is that it leads people to believe this is only allowing people to tax higher income at higher income tax rates and lower income people at lower income tax rates. In fact, it exposes everyone to higher income tax rates. It's about the power to do that. There's nothing in the amendment that requires these only, you know, it doesn't only give them the power to hike taxes on the rich. That's just not what it does.
But the rate system that they passed as such, Austin, forgive me, and I could be wrong here. I thought that the rates that they had already approved, though, would do what they're saying on the ballot. I agree with what you're saying, but right now, the way the rates are passed, if this passes, the rates that go into effect would do what they're saying is going to happen on this ballot.
Nominally, but I mean, I think it's a matter of semantics. That what it does allow, it, just as Austin said, it does allow for higher income brackets to be taxed at a higher rate and lower to be taxed at a lower rate, lower than the higher rate. That's self-evident, right? I mean,
I don't know.
No. So it allows for any bracket on any income. It allows for any bracket on any income. And the fact is, we're not voting on the rates. We're voting on opening up the Constitution, and then they can change it. The rates don't even go into effect till January 1st of next year. They could change them, you know, before they even go into effect if they want.
You could have higher rates on lower incomes and lower rates on.
Yes,
higher
you could.
Incomes.
It does allow that.
It allows for that, right?
Yes.
It does. So what it says on the ballot is not only true because it allows for it. Just And it also comports with common sense.
It says trust us. It says trust us. We will.
You're reading too much into that. Clearly, what they want to do is they want to set up a system of graduated income tax rates, tax brackets, like we have in the federal government. And nobody thinks that they're going to charge poor people a higher rate.
No.
I mean, that's real. I don't really think it's confusing. I really don't.
I thought you just said that they could charge higher rates to lower income.
They could.
They can.
I mean, it's true they could, but, you know.
Well, the ballot language says it gives the state the ability to impose higher tax rates on those with higher income levels and lower income tax rates on those with lower or middle income levels. So
if that's just an explanation, and that's true, maybe it's incomplete.
Let me ask you, Eric, about something else that an engineer, I was walking down the hall, he listened to this conversation either on the previous podcast or on the radio, and he said, wait a minute, and he handed me the bill as it was being debated, and the language that was struck, I thought was very interesting. There was a line in there that said that they can only have one graduated rate on one tax of a citizen at a given time, say your income. But they struck that. His point was they could have a graduated rate on your license tabs. They could have a graduated rate on any kind of tax or fee that you have now if this passes. So they'd say, well, you make a lot more money than that person does, so we're going to graduate the rate that you pay for your license or for a lot of things. Austin, is that an accurate summary of what is also possible here as a result?
So, yeah, it removes a number of key protections. One of them is the flat tax protection. Another one is that there may be no more than one such tax on income. So you could theoretically have like surcharges for things. It opens up all of these new possibilities. And for the explanation that everyone gets, and for many people, it is the only information they get to not at all mention any of those other things, or the fact that there's corporate rate changes tied to this. That's not mentioned either. Is highly misleading. And I think the easiest solution is give people the amendment to vote on. And I don't think that's extreme whatsoever. And I think one of the final point of this on the retirement tax portion, that goes to the powers here, because currently, and there's been so much misinformation the last couple of days from the AARP and from other groups saying this doesn't make it easier to tax retirement income, when it absolutely does. It makes it easier because, one, you can tax the graduated rates, which you can't do now. And the other one is that the other new power is you could tax it at a different rate than all of the other income, which you can't do now. Both of those things make it politically easier to do. And that should be a part of this conversation.
I was surprised to see that today, that the AARP really came out strong.
Yeah.
Not in alignment with you, Austin. They're for this, and it would seem to me like they're vulnerable. Mm-hmm.
This language, to me, is predatory to seniors. Every progressive tax state taxes retirement income, and there's nothing, and they put in the pamphlet that this does not tax retirement income, which is like saying if there was an amendment and you said this amendment does not kill puppies. It's like, well, no one is having that discussion. You just need to read the amendment and think about the consequences. So I was very disappointed by AARP. They're not representing the interests of seniors in this whatsoever.
I think the message has been out for a while now, because I heard my neighbors talking about it. They were asking me, sort of, does this have anything to do with starting to tax our retirement income, their retirees? And I said, well, that's not part of the discussion. And right now there's a prohibition, as we all know, on in Illinois on taxing retirement income. I suppose that would change, but I don't think there's any political will to do that, but there's nothing linked to that. And then I came in and kind of read the amendment again, which didn't tell me much, but then started reading some of our clips again, just to make sure, because I was sort of surprised. They're both really smart, plugged in people, and went back out and said, no, there's nothing in there, but I'm interested that you both think that, because, you know, where did you hear that? And I don't know if it was from the Daily Herald article. We're in the city, and that somehow got out or what. But this was 2 weeks ago, and they were both like, no, we're hearing this. I said, did you get literature? And I still don't know where. They still said, no, I think we heard it on the radio or something.
Well, there are TV ads now that have seniors talking about
now, but not 2 weeks ago.
Maybe they're big Mike Frerichs heads. they just follow everything he says.
Could be.
In the summer he said it. Yeah. He's been having the worst week ever because he's trying to defend those comments and he can't. And his comments were, this makes tax and retirement income clear that we can do that at graduated rates. And so he called a press conference to clarify that and then called it off at the last second because he was clearly uncomfortable answering questions about that remark. So Mike Frerichs is having a tough week.
Who is that? Who is Mike?
He's the state treasurer. He is most known for being a tall person.
That's right.
But he made the comment to a suburban chamber of commerce meeting and said that, you know, that's something that should be, I believe he said something about kind of tied the two, but then didn't, but said it should be on the table, taxing retirement income, which is kind of one
this
of the rules of politics. People.
The quote is one thing a progressive tax would do is make clear you can have graduated rates when you are taxing retirement income. Which is correct. And now he's trying to walk it back.
Right.
His boss
he's trying to
like
walk
that.
It back because it's massively unpopular in polls, which is why it's not going to happen.
You don't think this is going to pass, Eric?
Well, I don't know about the amendment's going to pass, but if you look at retirement, last time Paul Simon Public Policy Institute polled on this, it was like 73% of the population was against taxing retirement income. Yeah. I'm not exactly sure what the principal reason for that is, but I understand you don't want your poor grandmother who's scraping by to be charged extra money on her meager retirement pay. But you've got a lot of people who are making decent money, it seems like they should be taxed like everybody else by their income, the way they are in most places.
Hmm. Okay, guys, we've gone for a while here. We didn't get to the Emily in Paris Netflix TV series, which follows a Chicagoan in France. But it's filled with a lot of Chicago references. And there she is with her bosses who are from France. And they were talking about the American diet.
I was in Chicago once and I ate the deep dish pizza.
That is our specialty. We take a lot of pride.
It was rigorous. How you say?
Disgusting.
Like a quiche made of cement.
Oh, no, you must have gone to Lou Malnati's.
And the people are so fat. Why are they all so fat?
Well, perhaps from the disgusting food.
True.
And then, so then Lou's, I don't know if you saw this today, you probably did, but then they issued a press release saying, how dare they, especially in this time when restaurant workers are struggling. If you're sincere about that, don't say anything. People aren't watching that show like they're reading the Tribune. I actually think what they were doing, they actually turned it into a promotion. If you tweeted a certain hashtag or called in an order, that's what it was, with the certain promo code, they gave you $5 off a 4-pack of pizzas. So they're trying to make some hay with it. But I wonder from a PR standpoint, what do you do when something like that happens, you know?
I mean, I think it's just more evidence that Chicago has a giant chip on its shoulder and is always ready to fight people. And let's be real, I'm here for that. And I will defend Lou Malnati, the entire Malnati family, the franchise. Look, if they need me to punch a Hollywood starlet person, I will do that. But it's just, you know, Chicago's got that second city chip on its shoulder, and this plays right into it. Because we forget that we are actually a world-class city and we don't have to keep convincing people about it.
It's more evidence that we should distrust the French.
At least Condé Nast Traveler subscribers for the fifth year, was it, in a row, said best place to travel is Chicago. And they said glowing things about our architecture, our food, and even the people in this city. So... with the exception of Heather, we're all very, very nice, accommodating people. Austin, Heather, Lisa, Eric Zorn, thanks for joining us. We're produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.